You know how reading the instruction manual for building like a piece of complicated furniture makes it sound so incredibly elegant?
Oh yeah, like tab A fits perfectly into slot B.
Exactly. The diagrams are beautifully clean. They usually have these little arrows demonstrating exactly how everything just, clicks together.
In this totally frictionless ideal world.
Right. It just makes perfect sense on paper.
It's a beautifully engineered theory. I mean, the manual gives you this comforting illusion of control where everything is clean and predictable.
But then, you are actually sitting there on your living room floor.
Sweating.
Sweating,
Yeah.
yeah. You've got this tiny hex key digging into your palm. You've somehow ended up with three extra screws, and absolutely nothing is lining up the way it did in the picture.
It never does.
No. And suddenly, all that beautiful theory is completely out the window. You're just trying to force the pieces together without breaking them.
Well, the transition from abstract theory to messy flesh and blood reality is notoriously difficult. Whether you are building a bookshelf or, trying to build a philosophical framework for your life.
Yeah, that tension between the ideal and the reality is exactly where we're living today. So, welcome to today's deep dive.
We love the soaring ideals, but the execution is where we usually get stuck.
Right. And we are looking at some truly insightful session notes from Dr. Matthew S. Harmon today. We're focusing on his analysis of the biblical book of Philippians.
Specifically, chapter 2, verses 19 through 30.
Yes. And the mission for our deep dive today is all about crossing that bridge from high-minded concepts to dirt under your fingernails reality.
Because right before this section of the text, the Apostle Paul has just been laying out this massive cosmic theological vision.
Yeah, he's been talking about the ultimate example of a Christ-like mindset, total self-sacrificial humility.
But then he just slams the brakes.
He really does. He stops talking about the ultimate cosmic example, and he starts talking about two of his real-life, totally normal coworkers, Timothy and Epaphroditus.
Right. And our goal today is to extract the tangible, relatable nuggets of what self-sacrificial humility actually looks like for you, the listener.
In the messy crucible of everyday life.
Exactly. To really grasp the stakes here, though, we have to establish the physical context.
Yeah, set the stage for us.
Well, Paul isn't writing this from like an ivory tower or a comfortable study. He is dictating this letter from a Roman prison cell. Yeah, he is chained up. He's awaiting the resolution of his legal circumstances before the imperial court. He might be acquitted or he might be executed.
So it is a deeply precarious, high-stress situation.
Incredibly high stress. And yet, sitting in those chains, he realizes a fundamental truth about human nature. We are visual
We
learners.
need to see it.
Right. While the ultimate example of Jesus is foundational for his audience, human beings need tangible, real-life models to give those teachings richness and texture. Theory is great, but we need to see it walking around in sandals.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with Paul's first example, Timothy.
Yeah, Timothy.
Paul says he hopes to send Timothy to the Philippians soon, but the way he describes him is wild. He says, "I have no one like him."
That is incredibly high praise.
Coming from a historical heavy hitter like Paul, yeah. What makes Timothy so utterly unique?
It comes down to a very specific phrase in the original text. Paul says the Philippians know Timothy's proven worth.
Proven worth. That phrase is not just a casual compliment, is it?
No, not at all. The Greek concept used here, which also shows up in Romans chapter 5, by the way, carries the intense imagery of ancient metallurgy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were talking about the literal process of precious metals being tested and purified under intense consuming fire.
I love that imagery because it's so visceral. It's like forging a sword. You can have a piece of metal that looks shiny and sharp sitting on a table, but you don't really know if the metal is any good. You don't know if it has any structural integrity until it's been held to the heat of the forge.
Beaten with a hammer.
Exactly. Beaten with a hammer and plunged into water. You don't know it's a reliable weapon until it survives the fire.
And in ancient metallurgy, that fire wasn't just about shaping, it was about exposing impurities.
Right, getting the junk out.
Yes, when you heat silver or gold to a liquid state, all the dross, all the cheap material floats to the top so it can be scraped away.
So Paul is saying Timothy hasn't just read the theological manual on ministry.
No, he has been in the forge.
Yeah.
His character has been demonstrated by dealing with incurable difficult people, facing physical opposition, and, enduring the unglamorous daily grind of serving others.
He passed the metallurgy tests.
He did. His impurities were scraped away. And then Paul adds another critical layer to this description. He refers to Timothy serving alongside him as a son with a father.
Now, to a modern ear, that sounds nice. Maybe a little sentimental, like, oh, we're so close. He's like a son to me.
Sure.
But I imagine in a first century context, that phrase carried a much heavier vocational weight.
Oh, it carried an entirely different worldview.
Yeah.
In the ancient world, a son didn't just share your DNA and, you know, show up for holidays.
Right.
If your father was a carpenter, you were a carpenter. You apprenticed under him from the time you could walk.
You worked alongside him, learning every technique, every nuance of the trade.
Absorbing his work ethic, exactly. And beyond the occupational side, there's a deep cultural layer. A common Hebrew idiom at the time understood a son to perfectly resemble his father's characteristics.
Oh, like when Paul says in Ephesians that certain people are children of wrath.
Yes. Great example.
He doesn't mean wrath literally gave birth to them. He means they are so characterized by anger that wrath might as well be their parent.
Precisely. By calling Timothy a son, Paul is declaring that Timothy has deeply absorbed the core characteristics of Paul's life and mission.
Okay, I have to push back on this a little bit, though.
Sure.
If you're reading this as a skeptic, isn't it a bit arrogant for Paul to basically write a letter to an entire colony of people and say, look at Timothy, he's amazing because he's a carbon copy of me?
That's a fair question.
Like, you should all strive to be more like the guy who acts exactly like I do.
Well, what's fascinating here is the specific characteristic Paul is highlighting to avoid that exact trap of ego.
Okay, what is it?
The text explicitly contrasts Timothy with everyone else. Paul writes that everyone else seeks their own interests, but Timothy seeks the interests of Jesus Christ.
Ah.
Yeah, Timothy isn't a carbon copy of Paul's personality or his speaking style. He has absorbed Paul's Christ-like traits.
Specifically, that self-sacrificial humility of putting others first.
Exactly. He learned how to seek the interests of Christ by watching Paul do it when things got difficult.
Okay, so it's not Timothy is great because he's like me. It's Timothy is great because he acts like Christ, which is what I've been trying to teach you all to do, and he actually learned the lesson.
That's it, exactly.
But how does that translate to the listener today? Because organic life-on-life mentorship sounds amazing in theory.
Oh, absolutely.
But in 2026, it feels incredibly difficult to initiate. I mean, how do you step into a Paul or Timothy role without making it weird?
It requires abandoning the idea of formal, rigid programs and embracing shared friction.
Shared friction.
Yeah, you don't walk up to someone and say, I am now your mentor. Mm-hmm. You invite them into the messy parts of your life.
Right.
If you're the older, more experienced person, you invite a younger colleague or community member to help you tackle a difficult project.
Right.
Or you bring them along when you are serving somewhere.
You let them see how you react when the proverbial hex key isn't fitting into the furniture slot?
Exactly. There is a massive hunger for that kind of vulnerability today, but a severe shortage of people willing to let others see them sweat in the forge.
Man, that's good. So Timothy shows us the slow, lifelong marathon of mentorship. He's the slow burn in the forge.
Right.
But what happens when the crisis is acute? When you don't have years to prove your worth, but only days?
That brings us to Paul's second example.
Yeah, and we move from the long-term apprentice to the frontline career. Yeah. Paul brings up Epaphroditus.
Yes.
Now, Epaphroditus is in a completely different boat. He's the guy the Philippians originally sent to Rome to bring financial aid to Paul in prison.
He's essentially the delivery guy carrying a care package across an 800-mile, incredibly dangerous journey.
And now Paul is sending him back home.
Right. If Timothy is the long-term protege, Epaphroditus is the guy taking fire in the trenches right now.
Yeah.
The Philippian church pooled their resources, handed this guy the funds, and said, go find Paul in Rome and make sure he survives.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Look at the language Paul uses to describe this courier.
It's amazing.
He calls Epaphroditus brother, fellow worker, and fellow soldier. I mean, Paul is an apostle. He is writing foundational texts of the Christian faith.
And Epaphroditus is the guy who showed up with a bag of coins.
Right. But Paul completely levels the hierarchy. He doesn't treat him as a subordinate or an errand boy. They are peers in a shared, brutal struggle.
And we cannot overstate how severe that struggle was. The source notes reveal that while fulfilling this 800-mile mission to bring Paul aid, Epaphroditus fell incredibly ill.
He really did.
The text says he was near to death.
Mm-hmm.
But the truly striking element is his psychological state during this illness.
Right, because he wasn't agonizing over the fact that his body was shutting down.
No. The text notes he was distressed simply because the folks back home in Philippi had heard he was sick and he knew they would be worried about him.
That's wild.
And there's a massive linguistic key here that unlocks the depth of his empathy. The specific Greek term Paul uses here for Epaphroditus being distressed is eudaimonin.
Eudaimonin.
Yeah, it literally translates to a profound, crushing sense of disorientation, anguish, or the deep anxiety of being separated from one's people.
And that word eudaimonin is rare, right?
Incredibly rare. In fact, it only appears in two other places in the entire New Testament.
No.
Yeah, in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, describing Jesus's intense, crushing, emotional agony in the Garden of Gethsemane right before his crucifixion.
Wow.
When he was sweating drops of blood.
That changes the texture of the story completely. That is not just, oh man, I hope my friends aren't fretting about me back home.
No, it's a deep, psychological, agonizing distress.
But he's agonizing over their worry. It's like, imagine being on life support in the ICU, surrounded by machines keeping your organs functioning.
Right.
And you're using your absolute last ounce of breath to apologize to the exhausted nurses for making them walk into your room.
That is next level, unfathomable empathy.
It really is.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the source material draws a brilliant parallel to the overarching theme of the letter. Paul intentionally emphasizes that Epaphroditus came near to death for the work of Christ.
Okay.
Now, flip back a few paragraphs to how Paul described Jesus himself earlier in chapter 2. Christ was obedient to the point of death.
Oh, I see it. He is deliberately mirroring the language. He's saying, you want to know what the cosmic humility of Jesus looks like? Look at the guy gasping for air in the cot next to me.
Exactly. Epaphroditus is a living, breathing, severely flawed human being who is functionally acting out the theology of Jesus.
Yeah.
He risked his physical life traveling across an empire to complete what was lacking in their service to Paul.
Mm-hmm.
He put his actual physical body on the line.
And Paul notes that God had mercy on Epaphroditus and spared his life, which also spared Paul from experiencing sorrow upon sorrow while sitting in his chains.
Right.
So Epaphroditus survives the illness, the mission is accomplished, and Paul is sending him back home with this very letter. Which brings us to a fascinating cultural moment.
It does.
So what does this all mean? Paul explicitly commands the Philippian church to receive Epaphroditus with all joy and to honor such men.
Right.
Why does Paul have to issue a direct command for a celebration? If I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a first century resident of Philippi, shouldn't they just be naturally thrilled the guy didn't die?
Well, they probably were relieved, but Paul is doing some heavy lifting here to protect Epaphroditus's reputation.
Protect it from what?
First, he wants the church to know that this man didn't fail. He got sick. He was delayed, but he is returning as a highly successful messenger who risked everything.
Okay, that makes sense.
More importantly, Paul is colliding head-on with Greco-Roman culture.
Ah, because Philippi was a Roman colony, heavily populated by retired military veterans.
Right.
So their mindset is all about strength, right?
Right.
They value conquerors, gladiators, the cursus honorum, the literal race for political and social status.
Exactly that. In that Greco-Roman world, humility was absolutely not a virtue. It was viewed as a pathetic weakness, something reserved for slaves and the conquered.
Wow.
Honor was bestowed exclusively on the strong, the powerful, the wealthy benefactors. It was a society obsessed with climbing the ladder.
So by commanding them to officially honor Epaphroditus, a guy whose singular claim to fame in this story was almost dying out of self-sacrificial service, Paul is entirely subverting their cultural values.
He is demanding they elevate a man, specifically for his weakness, his vulnerability, and his humility.
That was a radical, almost offensive paradigm shift for a Roman colony.
Highly offensive to their sensibilities.
It's turning the whole concept of heroism upside down. We don't throw a parade for the general who conquered the neighboring city. We throw a parade for the delivery guy who almost killed himself trying to bring soup to a prisoner because he loved us so much.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah.
And the source material pivots here to bring this ancient paradigm directly to the listener's life today.
Okay.
Because it's very easy to look at Timothy and Epaphroditus and think, well, they're characters in the Bible. Of course they did amazing things.
Right.
But there's a theological trap many people fall into here, especially those coming from faith traditions that heavily emphasize the absolute sovereignty of God.
The hyper-sovereignty trap. Let's unpack that for a second, because that term gets thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
What exactly is the danger there?
The danger is a mindset of passive resignation.
Passive resignation.
Yeah, if you believe God is completely sovereign, all-powerful, and steering human history, the trap is thinking, well, God is going to get his will done no matter what.
Right.
He holds the universe together, so it really doesn't matter what I do on a Tuesday afternoon. He certainly doesn't need my help.
I mean, well, logically speaking, that feels true. Yeah. An all-powerful being doesn't need a human being to accomplish a goal.
He doesn't need us. But the text demonstrates that he chooses to use his people to advance his interests.
Oh, okay.
The theological reality of God's sovereignty shouldn't lead to a listener's passivity. It should be the very engine of their active, joyful participation.
Because God chooses to use our specific gifts, our available time, and our physical energy to comfort the prisoner, to mentor the younger colleague, to build the community.
Exactly.
But I'm putting myself in the shoes of a listener right now, someone who is hearing this and thinking, okay, that's great for Paul, Timothy, and Epaphroditus. They were basically full-time first century ministry guys.
Sure.
But I'm not a pastor. I don't have a seminary degree. I don't know ancient Greek. I'm just a regular person working a 9-to-5, trying to pay a mortgage, keep my kids fed, and avoid completely burning out by Friday.
Right.
How does this ancient heroism apply to an exhausted modern worker?
This raises an important question about how we fundamentally view our identity. The notes introduce a brilliant concept here that we can think of as the whole pie paradigm.
The whole pie paradigm.
Yeah. In our contemporary hyper-scheduled culture, we survive by compartmentalizing. We treat our lives like slices of a pie.
Okay.
You have your career slice, your family slice, your gym slice, your hobby slice. And then neatly tucked between your fantasy football league and your grocery shopping is your faith slice.
Right. You carve out an hour or two on Sunday morning to deal with the faith slice. You feel good about it.
And then Monday morning, your alarm goes off and you completely switch gears back to the career slice. But true, Christ-like service, the kind we see in the forge with Timothy and in the trenches with Epaphroditus, utterly shatters that compartmentalized model.
How so?
Your identity as a follower of Christ isn't a slice of the pie. It is the metal pan that holds the entire pie.
Oh, wow.
It shapes, defines, and provides the boundaries for every single aspect of your life.
Let me push back on that, though. For that exhausted 9-to-5 worker, hearing faith is the whole pan sounds like you are just adding a massive amount of weight to their shoulders.
I can see how it sounds that way.
It sounds like you're saying they need to be doing ministry 24/7 on top of their actual job.
It's actually the exact opposite. It's profoundly freeing because you aren't adding new tasks to your exhausting to-do list.
Yeah.
You are changing the why of your existing tasks.
The why?
Yes. How you treat your incredibly difficult coworkers, the integrity with which you manage your company's finances, how you patiently respond to your toddler throwing a tantrum. All of those mundane daily moments are contained within that identity. You don't need a specific ministry background.
Mm-hmm.
God uses whatever gifts and whatever stressful circumstances you find yourself in right now.
The moment you are willing to lay down your own agenda and seek the interests of others.
Exactly.
It's about being willing to step into the fire wherever you happen to be standing.
Yes.
Which brings us to the core takeaway from our deep dive today. When we look at these flesh and blood co-workers of Paul, the overarching theme is undeniable. God's servants show their true colors by risking it all.
They really do.
They risk their time, they risk their comfort, they risk their resources, and sometimes even their physical lives to sacrificially serve others.
Timothy demonstrated it through a lifetime of proven, faithful mentorship and the slow burn of steady service.
Yeah.
And Epaphroditus demonstrated it through a dramatic, life-threatening sprint of empathy and courage. Both of them laid down their own interests for something far bigger than themselves.
And we don't want this to just be an interesting history lesson about first century Rome.
No, absolutely not.
Our source material actually issues a direct, tangible challenge for you, the listener. Sometime today, we challenge you to identify someone in your immediate life who embodies this kind of faithful, humble, Christ-like service.
Often it's someone who goes completely unnoticed because they actively avoid seeking the spotlight.
Right.
Like the person cleaning up after the event or the coworker quietly covering for someone else's mistake.
Exactly that person. Find them. Send them a text message right now. Write them a quick email. Or if you see them in the hallway, pull them aside.
Tell them specifically how God has blessed you through their unseen service.
The goal isn't to artificially puff up their ego, but to deeply honor them by acknowledging the work God is doing through them. Give them that countercultural honor that Paul demanded for Epaphroditus.
It is a simple 2-minute action, but it reinforces the very fabric of a healthy, resilient community.
So pull out your phone and send that text today. But before we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over on your own. It builds on a concept we touched on right at the beginning. We talked about Timothy having proven worth.
Yes.
And how that Greek word was tied to the literal imagery of a crucible, metals being tested, hammered, and purified under intense fire.
The ancient metallurgy test.
Right. Now, in our modern everyday lives, we don't usually face the threat of a Roman prison or an 800-mile trek on foot.
Thankfully.
Instead, we face daily inconveniences. We face the delayed flights, the frustrating coworkers who refuse to pull their weight, the sudden expensive changes in our weekend plans.
All those fun things.
All of it. We habitually view these things as annoying interruptions to our real lives. We just want to get past them so we can get back to the good stuff. But what if we completely changed our perspective?
How do you mean?
What if those very interruptions, those mundane daily frustrations, are actually your modern day crucible? What if the annoying coworker isn't an interruption to your life, but the exact forge where your proven worth is being hammered out right now? How might reframing your single biggest, most stressful frustration today as a purposeful metallurgy test completely change the way you react to it tomorrow?
That reframing changes everything. The fire isn't there to destroy you. The fire is there to reveal exactly what you're made of.
Something to think about the next time you're stuck in traffic and your blood pressure starts to rise. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.